What does blood memory mean to you?
What does blood memory mean to me? I think it's the memory that we inherit from our ancestors, the things that we've never been told specifically or taught specifically, but it's part of our DNA. It's part of who we are that gets that we inherit from our ancestors. I think that's blood memory, and it's something that I've always believed in.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast all about authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Jennifer Finley about her collection of poetry, My Hands Have Vertigo, an emotional swim through sadness following her divorce.
Let's just jump in and have you read Bitterroot Day.
Okay, Bitterroot Day. Bitterroot Day. It rained, gentle, sloppy, splashy, mud puddly rain. I went to the Bitterroot Mountains alone, whispering random melodies and prayers. In this month, the end of the hunting month, the last of our people moved away in 1891. In my ancestral home that still belongs to my heart, I stopped at a secondhand store called Little Bit of Hope. But I did not buy any sweat-stained shoes worn by someone else. The people who now live where my ancestors live make me feel uneasy. I do not trust them to be good stewards of this land. My blood memory is strong and knows the pitch of the land's voice. The land knows the smell of my hair. This land knows my daughter and both my sons by name. Once, women who looked like me woke up on fall mornings and heard river water, rain, and their own children playing and breathing all over our land. My ancestors prayed for their children, and I will always pray for mine.
What is your relationship, both personal and ancestral, to the Bitterroots? And maybe you can also describe what the Bitterroots are.
Okay, so the Bitterroot Mountains are sacred mountains to the Salish. And my grandmother and grandfather are both full-blooded Salish people. And my great-grandfather is buried in the Bitterroot. And so in 1891, the last of the Salish left the Bitterroot for the Flathead Reservation, which is where I live now. But at one point, this whole area of Montana was our ancestral land. So we're on one small piece of it. So I grew up hearing stories that my grandmother told about the Bitterroot and about magical things that happened there. And so I always felt a strong connection to that place, even though I didn't grow up in the Bitterroot. I feel like that land never forgot me. And our people are buried there. Our prayers are there. And I feel like it's that land still loves me and it still knows me.
In the poem Res Man, you say that the land loves you. What does it mean to be loved by the land?
I think it means to be loved by a piece of yourself. So one of my dear friends, Julie Cajun, always says that our name for ourselves, the Salish people, is flesh of the land. So we're a piece of this land. The land is a piece of us. And so by saying that the land loves us, it's saying to me, I think that it's a piece of us that still loves us. And so as a yoga teacher, one of the things that you learn about yoga is that the deepest part of you is love. And I think that the land is an embodiment of that. It's a piece of ourself that grows, that has faith in reproduction and reaching for the sky and being orange and being purple and being beautiful. That's what it means to me.
Mm. Also in the poem Res Man, you write, I'm assuming about your home in Arlee.
Yes.
Yet for different reasons, it's hard to live here. What do you mean by that?
Okay. So in the poem Res Man, I wrote this poem about Derek. And he is, so this is what happens on our reservation a lot. You know, there's this whole idea of enrollment and skin color and all of these issues that internally turn us against each other in lots of different ways. Mm-hmm. So some people are made fun of because they're too dark. So growing up, people made fun of me because I'm very brown. And I know other people who get made fun of because they're Native, but they don't look Native, they look white. And so internally, we have these ways that we are mean to each other, but on this, at the same time, we have to endure this outside oppression and racism from the dominant society in addition. So it's piled on top of this internal oppression that we have going on, this internalized oppression. And so it is hard for lots of us to live on the reservation for lots of different reasons. And so a lot of this internalized oppression, internalized racism comes out in lots of different ways. And so for me, it's because I'm very brown. For someone else, it might be because they're light. For someone, it might be because they're enrolled. Someone's not enrolled. So there's all these issues that we deal with inside our community that I think are forms of internalized oppression and racism.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's hear Resman then.
Okay. Resman for Derek. One night, you came to my house and changed my tire, late in the evening after it rained all day, and the ground was cold and wet. You are the first non-relative I trusted to babysit my kids. You can make Greek sauces and you know how to cook salmon. You are strong, over 6 feet tall. Your hands can crush another man's pride, but you are not a man who puts fear into anybody smaller than you. I am your mother's friend. Do you know how deeply she wishes everything good for you? Your mother would forsake you for nothing in this world, and for that you are wildly blessed. You are Salish, like me, and we are both loved by this land. Yet, for different reasons, we know how hard it is to live here. It still surprises me when men are kind and don't give me reasons to be afraid. Thank you for your kindness, for it gives me hope in this place.
So many of these poems have individual dedications?
Yes.
What can you say about that?
I think in so many ways, this book is really about people who shaped my life and taught me something after my divorce. And whether or not they're still part of my life, they taught me something really important about myself and about what I want and what I don't want. And so they're just people who touched my life in some way and taught me something that I needed to learn.
I want to talk about this book as a reflection of the divorce process. But before we do that, going back to the land, what's the conversation that you have with landscape?
It's so interesting. In my first book that came out when I was 25, I did my first ever poetry reading, and someone in the audience said, almost every one of your poems has landscape in it. And that was the first time I even recognized that about myself. And so I think it's just something that's inherently how I think about the world. So I feel like every landscape has something to teach us. It has a specific energy. And I really noticed that when I moved to the Southwest, because I grew up in Arleigh. I was born and raised on the Flathead Reservation. But then I went to college in New Mexico, and I was in this wildly different landscape, and I realized that my thoughts were different. So different landscapes affect how you think. They affect how you perceive yourself and your place in the world. So I went from being surrounded by trees and deer and moose and bears and birds everywhere and a place where it rains frequently to some place that was like living on the moon. There's no water, no trees. And the things that live there are really small and quiet. And when the rains come, it's a flood. It's a flash flood. It's such a stark contrast to Montana. And living in that radically different landscape really taught me a lot about how I think differently and how different places have different blessings and different things to teach us.
Your book also references Hawaii and Martha's Vineyard. What do you know about the blessings from those places?
So I've been pretty fortunate to travel a little bit. So I have been to Hawaii a few times, and I have met some amazing and beautiful, brilliant Hawaiian people. And I just see so many connections between them and us and their connection to water. So my connection is to land, and the ocean is a very foreign animal to me, and it's scary. I don't understand the ocean. And they're ocean people. And so I feel like that was interesting to think about that, the spiritual properties of different kinds of water and their relationship to their land. And I feel like it just, in knowing them, I feel like it really validated a lot of things that I feel, that we're not the only people who feel this way. We're not the only people who have this in our community. And when I looked at the Hawaiians, they were so beautiful physically and in every way you could be beautiful. They were beautiful. And I thought, how could people like this not see their beauty? When they look at themselves, when they look at each other, how could they not see anything but beauty? And then I look at my own community and I thought, do people look at us from the outside and say, these people are so beautiful, how could they see anything but? And so I felt like that was a gift I got from them. And then my connection to Martha's Vineyard, I married a man who was from there. So I was able to spend time there. And again, just being on and near the ocean on this little island. And somehow, you know, after growing up in Montana and spending time on an island, it made me realize how connected I am to the world. The ocean made me feel connected to foreign lands in ways that I never felt connected to foreign lands growing up in Montana.
How would you describe your own relationship to your beauty?
Oh, that's a really hard question. That's a very emotional question for me. Thank you for asking me that. I think that growing up brown in Montana and in America was really, really hard. And there was no place or no one or no thing that ever told me I was beautiful or had anything important to say. And so I really think that growing up in those circumstances, it's truly miraculous that I became a poet, that there's part of me that's a fighter, that there's part of me that's a rebel, that there was part of me that could stand up to the status quo of where I was raised. There was part of me that could stand up to the status quo in this country. And instead of buying into this idea that I had nothing important to say, that I stood up to that and I became a writer. And I feel like every time I write something, it's an act of resistance. And every time I accept my beauty and acknowledge the beauty in others, it's an act of resistance.
One thing I heard you say publicly that's stuck with me is, I refuse to see myself through anyone else's eyes.
Yes. And so that's the part of me that's a fighter. That's the part of me that continually has to rise up against the status quo. And it took me a while to get there. And I think being able to do that, being able to see myself and see my own worth, regardless of what anybody else thinks, it's a practice. It's like yoga. It's something you have to continually practice.
You've been listening to Jennifer Finley talk about her collection of poems, My Hands Have Vertigo. This is The Right Question. I'm Sarah Aronson. If you're just joining us, this full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and find a link to our Facebook page.
Talk about love.
Yes.
In your poem, A Woman's Love, you write, because loving is the bravest thing we will ever do.
Yes, I absolutely believe that. And I think it takes the greatest amount of courage to love, to even reach for it, to even think that it's possible.
I want to hear "I have no reason."
Okay. I have no reason. I have no reason to believe in love, except that I have loved. I loved stupidly, honestly, drunkenly, carelessly. Love has a mind of its own. I have loved many times and didn't know why some of the men I loved didn't love me back. For you, I pray this. If you love someone who does not love you, may your hands protect the softness of your own throat and give your voice mercy. May you press both hands against your chest to stop yourself from arguing with something as drunk and wild as love.
I have to know exactly what you meant by the last line, to stop yourself from arguing with something as drunk and wild as love.
I think love is something that's the opposite of logic. I think it's our most basic human need. We all are born in this world not just reaching for food and for physical connection. I think we're all hardwired to love and be loved. And I think it's, love is something that's magical, and it's something that it has a mind of its own. It's a force entirely of its own.
This book in part comes on the heels of a divorce.
Yes.
Anything you would share about that?
I think that here's how I recently described myself as a poet to someone who has never read poetry. I said, as a poet, I feel my way through the world with words. I pet cats with words. I grab cold bottles with words. I dig in dirty junk boxes with words. It's how I feel my way through the world. So with these poems that I wrote after my divorce, it's how I felt my way through the world after my divorce. It's how I navigated my way back to myself. And what I realize now is that life is a continual process that reroutes us back to ourselves constantly. And I think, I don't know about other people, but I know I'm constantly like going off track, going off course, taking detours. And then life always reroutes me back to myself, back to myself, back to myself. And I think my divorce was one of those monumental events in my life that rerouted me back to myself in some really painful ways. But the ending turned out to be really good. And these poems are how I felt my way through that, how I felt my way through all of those really painful moments where I felt like I was swimming in an ocean of black sadness. It's how I did it, by writing these.
Writing your way back.
Yeah. Yes.
So you've emerged, as Mark Gibbons writes in the introduction, as a monarch butterfly, coming back to your name, Jennifer Finley. What's that been like to come back to your name?
Yeah, so I think that was really important to me too, is just coming back to myself and who I really am. And getting a divorce is not just... Words are so important to me, and now I call myself a different name than I had when I was married. And it has a different weight, it has a different energy, and I feel more like myself coming back to my maiden name.
Will you read "I Drove"?
I Drove, okay.
On page 12.
I Drove, for DM. Once, I drove back in time to see you. Down a two-lane Montana highway, past once opulent hotels, man-heavy bars packed with empty cars parked outside. As I drove, the only stations I could get were hits from the 80s and some religious music. I bought coffee and haver and rolled down the window. I ran over one rabbit and one gopher. You were waiting for me in your bed, and you left the door open.
Reading the book, I felt a series of acute emotions: longing, sorrow, desire, loss, sacrifice, and even protection.
Yes.
In thinking about "I Drove," what's the emotion that comes to mind for you? the most, maybe.
I actually remember that. And I think writing about that is that driving through all of these broken places, these places that had once been opulent and beautiful and filled with people and businesses that were almost abandoned, but people still had faith and people showed up anyway. And people still in these little towns in northern Montana, up on the High Line, towns that I've never heard of, people still live there. They still have some connection and some love to that place. And I think love is kind of like that. It's that piece of us that will hold on to this almost ghost town of something that was once opulent and beautiful, and we still have faith in it, and we still see something of value in it, just like we do with some people.
Right, and one of the things I love about that poem is driving back, you know, there are these sacrifices, a gopher and a rabbit, which just seems so true to life as well.
Yeah.
Will you read Blessing?
Yes. Blessing. Once my tooth cracked open, and each time I breathed, pain pulsated, blossomed like spilled ink in my mouth. I was broke and couldn't afford to see the dentist and had nothing valuable enough to sell. You gave me money to see a dentist. I was so grateful. I loved you so much. The dentist turned out to be unlicensed. Because of his work, I wound up with an infection and a fake tooth. That was many years ago, when you still wanted to wake up with me every morning. I didn't have any lines in my forehead, and I was nobody's mother. You'll no longer swim with me at night, and you won't kiss any songs into my hair, and you can't help me when my chest feels like a broken ceramic plate. But once, you were a blessing to me, like the smell of lilac blowing through an open window after a long winter.
What does it take for you to come to a place of gratitude? And I'm not sure gratitude is the right word, but
I think it takes allowing myself to feel as sad as I need to feel and not running away from it. It's looking into an ocean of sadness, literally an ocean, and saying, okay, the only way to get to the land on the other side is to swim through this. And I can't see the bottom. It's over my head. And I can't see the other piece of land on the other side. And I think there's sharks in here. And it's dark outside. And I'm scared. But to swim through it anyway. I think that's how you do it.
Did you have any comforts along the way?
My cat. At one point, I seriously thought my cat was my soulmate. Uh-huh. I thought, my soulmate is not a human. My soulmate is a cat. So definitely my cat. And just this blind faith that things could be different. And I think sometimes we have to do what we need to do to cultivate this blind faith that I don't know how things could be different, but they can be. And having faith in something that you can't even see the shape of or the form of yet.
Reading your book, I also sensed some humor in the pain. Can you tell me why you needed to write the poem, Dear College in Alaska, that sent me two rejection letters?
Yeah, I just think that rejection is unavoidable. And sometimes we're rejected in really surprising and humiliating ways. And that's just part of life. And sometimes, you know, sometimes it makes us cry and sometimes we just have to laugh and move on and not apply to any more jobs in Alaska.
Jennifer, in thinking about the publication of this book, I want to start with the title. Where does the title come from?
My Hands Have Vertigo.
Mm-hmm.
So it's based on one of the poems in the book entitled My Hands Have Vertigo. And I just think it speaks about the complete lack of logic and common sense that love brings to the table. And that not only like can we feel the sense of dizziness and spinning out of control when we're in love with someone, but sometimes our body feels like it's drunk almost with this feeling of desire or love or whatever.
What was the process of publishing this book like? Because my sense is originally it was going to come out with your former publisher, Foothills.
It was. And so I feel like I did something that no writer ever does. And I know so many writers who would give, you know, their one of their hands to be published in anything, anywhere. And that I had a publisher who wanted to publish this book. And I was teaching out in Rocky Boy.
So I was Rocky Boy is where?
Rocky Boy is up in northern Montana near the Canadian border. And it's a very isolated place. There are no towns. So it's the Rocky Boy Reservation. I was teaching students out there. There are no towns on this reservation. There's no post office and no cell service. It's a very isolated place. So I spent a year teaching there. And so I was up there teaching. And I thought, I kept thinking about my work. And again, coming back to this, having this blind faith in myself. And I thought about it and thought about it, and I decided I'm going to take a huge leap of faith in myself and in my work. And I'm starting my own press, and I'm publishing my own book. So again, you know, knowing where I come from and how I grew up, that is like crazy. And also I know that if I ever decide to go back to academia and be a professor, I know that it has less, I don't think I could count it towards like seeking tenure or anything. So I thought, I don't care. I'm taking this blind leap of faith in myself and in my work. I'm starting my own press and I'm going to publish my own work. So I have complete control over my own words and where they go and how they're used. So I decided to do that. And I plan on publishing the works of other writers too, but I thought, if I publish my own book first, I can work out the logistics of distribution and promotion and how all of this actually works. So I'm really excited about it.
And the dedication of the book is, I dedicate this book to you, for you have always been worth loving.
Yes. So that's to anybody who reads that, because we've all always been worth loving. Every single one of us has always been worth loving. And that even if there are people in your life who don't love you, the sky loves you, the ocean loves you, the land loves you. You are always connected to something that loves you.
Jennifer was born and raised on the Flathead Reservation in Montana. She lives in Arlee. Look for more information about her and her book and subscribe to our podcast at mtpr.org. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin's studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.